The reading this morning is taken from Psalm 73 in the Hebrew Scriptures, verses 3 through 18. For I was envious of the arrogant. I saw the prosperity of the wicked, for they have no pain. Their bodies are sound and sleek. They are not in trouble as others are. They are not plagued like other people. Therefore, pride is their necklace. Violence covers them like a garment. Their eyes swell out with fatness. Their hearts overflow with follies. They scoff and speak with malice. Loftily, they threaten oppression. They set their mouths against heaven, and their tongues range over the earth. Such are the wicked, always at ease. They increase in riches. All in vain I have kept my heart clean and washed my hands in innocence. All day long I have been plagued and am punished every morning. But when I thought how to understand this, it seemed to me a wearisome task. Until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I perceived their end. Truly, you set them in slippery places. You make them fall to ruin. Before I go on, I want to thank you for your warm welcome this morning, and I want to thank all those who have been so gracious in welcoming myself and my companion here at Star King, Jessica, who's waving from the front. And it's wonderful to be in a congregation. I think that this is the first congregation that I have preached in where the entire full-time permanent ministerial staff are all Star King graduates, which makes us very happy indeed out in Berkeley. And Joe, I just want you to know that you're welcome to be a special student at any time, because why should you miss all the fun? And I bring greetings from our colleagues in Berkeley, California. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. So once upon a time, before there was Facebook or Tinder or Match.com, there was this anachronistic thing called a personal ad. Does anybody remember personal ads? They ran in Penny Shoppers. They were in the New York Village Voice. And even now, you can see a very intellectual version in the New York Review of Books. If you look in the back, it's very bizarre. But wherever they ran, they were as varied as the rainbow, and people who were seeking companionship had a host of abbreviations to explain their personal preferences. And, you know, they had to use abbreviations because words cost money, so they were shrinking them down. So there were people, ISOSWM or GBM or SWF or SJW, and all those letters meant something. ISO meant in search of, SWM meant straight white male, GBM meant a black male who was gay, straight white female was the meaning behind SWF, and SJW meant straight Jewish woman. It was simpler then. But times have changed, and in most parts of the United States, you find other ways of people connecting to one another, and these abbreviations and these words, they morph, they change, and I pride myself with keeping up with the evolving nature of the English language. I've been a writer basically since I was 8 years old, so I love words. And so you can always look things up, and when all else fails, there is the Urban Dictionary. And you should get to know the Urban Dictionary. It's a really good thing. It's a resource. So imagine my surprise several decades later to run across this brand new iteration of the abbreviation SJW. I first ran across it in the most dangerous place in social media, the comment section in an article in the Huffington Post. Now, if I were compiling my own private dictionary, I would call comment sections that area of social media sites most likely to provide evidence against the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Now, you know I'm right because you read them. Because the trolls are always out in force in these places. They make all these negative comments. They call the authors all kinds of names. They get into fight with other commentators who try to protect the other ones. It's just a nightmare. On this particular occasion I was reading, some troll called another person an SJW and told her she should go back to her safe space. And I was confused because I didn't understand what being a straight Jewish woman had to do with being in a straight space, in a safe space. But the sarcastic quality of the language suggested something other than anti-Semitism to me. It was that, you know, that snide, condescending tone that you hear from conservative writers and thinkers sometimes who are talking to progressive people in a manner more befitting small children, right? But that gave me something to go on, so I got in touch with my favorite conservative, my brother. Now, many of you like my brother, because my brother is the technology writer for the Boston Globe. So if you've read Hiawatha Bray, you have read my brother. And I'm going to tell him he has fans, because he's a rock star in New England. I keep telling him that. But I called him and I said, what is SJW? What does that mean? And actually, he texted me back. He said it was shorthand for a term, social justice warrior. Social justice warrior. So you think that's a bad thing? You and your friends, that's an insult? That's my lifelong aspiration. I was floored, and then I was thrilled, and then I went to the Urban Dictionary because I wanted to see what they said, and the comments were even more appalling than the ones on the thread. The top definition, because they rank them, you know, people kind of rank their favorite definition, and the top definition for social justice warrior on the site was quoted as a person who causes problems for normal people through protest and constant nagging because they can't accept that life isn't fair. Oh, for real. You should go look. So they just have tons of examples. The web is full of these of all kinds of parodies about social justice warriorship. And the problem is that we think of them as parodies, but other people read them as serious. And that's a problem. It's a problem because it leans us in this direction of not being able to answer a larger problem. And we do have a larger problem right now because our country and its people and the democracy itself all are in mortal danger. And when I preach this sermon around the country, the more I preach it, the more dangerous the situation becomes with each passing time I talk about it. It may already be too late, in fact. And the very fact that it may be too late suggests that we who sit in this sanctuary cannot be satisfied simply with being social justice warriors, being proud of the term, being dismissive of the people who dismiss us for doing what we love to save this democracy and this country. The times that we live in are terrible. They just are. And they demand more of us, maybe more than we think we have. But we have to try, and we have to be smart, and we have to be strategic, and we have to be spiritual in our social justice warriorship. How many of you have your pussy hat still? I saw somebody come in with one. I got mine. I knit mine at 2 o'clock in the morning. I finished mine at 2 o'clock in the morning the day before the march in Washington because I had to find different kinds of thread. It was a nightmare. I had to learn Kitchener stitch. Those of you who knit, you know what I mean. But I've got mine. How many of you marched? How many of you joined Indivisible or some other organization? And I want to suggest to you there are not enough hands up in here. How many of you consider yourself part of what is known as the resistance? That's good. Everything I mentioned just now, they're all good things for social justice warriors like ourselves to do and to be. But the problems we face now are larger than the stopgap measures that we've created, in part to help us manage our own spiritual despair. Part of the issue facing us as progressive religious people is denial. We rushed past our despair over the disastrous election of more than a year ago, and we leaned into this busy work of protest instead of allowing our hearts to break, instead of sitting with the deep misery of watching a lifetime of work for some of us, a lifetime of work, begin to disappear. I think if we had sat with that despair a little longer, we might be further along in the spiritual regeneration that we will need. It is the necessary precursor to the political and activist regeneration that is urgently needed if our democracy is to survive. This is one reason I chose the reading I did today. I turned to Scripture and to Psalms, the prayer book of the Bible, because I knew that if there were a record of human despair in the context of great evil, I would find it there. And there's a lot of it. There's a lot in the Psalms about watching the wicked prosper. And so it was with Psalm 73, with these words that sounded as though they were coming from the inside of my head, much more eloquent than my own words, but they were just this thing. I was envious of the arrogant. I saw the prosperity of the wicked because they had no pain. They are not in trouble like others are. They are not plagued like other people. And they do look so happy on TV. They look untroubled. They look unplagued while we can't sleep. But we cannot allow that to be the last word. As progressive people of faith, and I say that together, progressive people of faith, we have to stand up. We have to stand up against the growing threat of a theocratic state being imposed on us while we stand around trying to figure out what tactics we like better and who's more right about what they do than the other people. Much has been said about the influence of white evangelicals in the current administration, and I want to take a moment to remind us all that white evangelicals comprise 16.1% of the United States population. 16.1%. And yet that group of people stand poised to revoke the constitutional guarantee of a wall between church and state. A newly hijacked Supreme Court is set right now to hear cases like Masterpiece Bakery, the Colorado small business that refused to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple, and their argument is that asking them to bake that cake is a violation of the baker's freedom of religion. And we, as progressive religious people, have been a little too casual in our struggle for religious freedom and what it means and whose religious freedom matters. Many of us still think are still stuck in this idea about it meaning freedom from religion. We still have people in our congregations who conflate Christianity with the people who represent that faith. And we join in with other groups whose emphasis demands that we draw this extra bright line between church and state. And we rightly do that because that separation has protected all of us from the imposition of what could amount to a state church. But we often miss a precious opportunity to remind ourselves and to model for our country the notion that there is more than one way to be religious. That because religion and politics have never been separate in this country, and I don't believe they should be. I believe church and state should be separate, but not religion and politics. The government has to pay attention to the ways in which our religious values, as Unitarian Universalists, our religious values, as progressive religious people, need to be protected in this nation too. We joined other religious communities in claiming that civil marriage was a civil right, and we were right about that. But we also missed an opportunity to remind civil society that to deny marriage equality to any two people in love was to elevate one set of religious values above another. That the denial of this fundamental human right was also to deny the right of the people in our congregations and the ministers in our faith tradition to practice our faith and to live out our belief that love is love is love. That is our religious posture. And we need to begin to talk about it as a religious position. We may have thought these battles were over, but the truth is they are only just getting started. And the wicked among us are not troubled. They prosper. It will take people like us to trouble them. When we enter sanctuaries of the holy, like this one, we do it to gain strength and courage so that we can sustain the fight. This is a long fight. We cannot fight these people alone, but we can join with others who share our religious values. And they may not be perfect. They may not be a perfect match. But still, we must begin to build coalitions strategically around the issues that are important to us. If I could wave a magic wand and get all our congregations and all of its people to focus on three things, I would do this. I would focus on removing money from politics so that corporations and individuals who own those corporations, the Koch brothers and the DeVoses and the Mercers, could stop buying our democracy. I would help people and help people focus on fighting voter suppression tactics so that people of color who are being turned away from voting booths and removed from the voting rolls have an actual chance to vote for the progressive values that we share. And if you think that voter suppression is something that used to happen, you haven't been paying attention. And if you think those efforts will not be redoubled by the midterms, you are mistaken. And the last thing I would do is encourage everybody to run for office. Any elected office, every elected office. Because if the person who occupies the White House right now can be called upon to govern, so can you. I would tell you to run for school board, run for city council, run for dog catcher, run for whatever is out there, but run. Because that's where it begins. We're struggling against a tide of profoundly conservative, anti-democratic people who started running for school boards 20 and 30 years ago and worked their way up into state politics and from there into national politics. We are way behind the curve. So we need to start now if this matters to us. All of this takes stamina. This fight for our country will be bitter and it will be long, but it is urgent. And that is why it is just as urgent for us to be spiritual justice warriors, starting yesterday. In our world, in our faith, in our lives, we have such important work to do. We have to practice resurrection. We have to practice renewing our love. We have to practice taking a deep breath and risking ourselves for the sake of a better future. We don't know how it's going to turn out, but we have to try. We have to be willing to look ourselves in the eye and ask ourselves all kinds of hard questions about all kinds of things, about the way we do church, about the way we use power or refuse to use it, about the way we act as allies against oppression or the ways we refuse to act. We have to ask ourselves these things. But we also have to ask those tough questions and leaven them with kindness. Not excuses, but kindness, abundant kindness in all that we do. Not just for the sake of ourselves, but also for the sake of those with whom we labor. We have a long road to travel. A long road. And just because we have this long road, how we travel, how we travel will matter just as much as where we hope to go. We will need kindness because it will make our common journey easier, and we will need to exercise it like a muscle so that it will be ready for the rough patches. And I can promise you that it will be rougher before it will be better. Those of us of progressive religious faith, though, we know that we are not alone in these rough spots. The psalmist knew that when he talks about the Holy One being present even when he despaired, for when he went into the sanctuary of God, he understood more and perceived their downfall. The late Unitarian Universalist poet Mae Sarton once wrote about her good friend and caretaker, calling him my good luck in a dirty time. My good luck in a dirty time. That is one of the most important things we should be looking for. Those people and those communities who will reveal themselves to be our good luck in a dirty time. And it is even more important for us to embrace the many ways that we might be for others their good luck in a dirty time, to show up everywhere and in every way that we can, not only as good luck,